now. I know your mind.
It always has been, it always will be. 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 It always has been, it always has been. It always has been, it always has been. It always happens, it always happens. 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 It always happens. This always happens, 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 this always happens.
It always will be, 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 it always will be.
They grind that hustle. Got that call, that crawl, that ruffle. till you make it. You know they cannot break it. And every day got you looking at me sideways.
You are listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, online at WFMU.org. This has been Materialized with Naomi Shamble. It has been an absolute pleasure, and we have a very special show up next from our very own Jim the Poet back. Thankfully, the missing crown jewel of WFMU has returned. No shade. Love Alan, too. I mean, I asked, and Alan told me to stay off the rock. So, yeah, great. Never had a problem with it, but good advice. That said, Jim the Poet's movie review show is on. Love you all.
Hello, we're back. This is Jim the Poet, WFMU, three thumbs up, Steely Dan for some reason. Our number is 201-209-9368. Big hand for Naomi Shamble!
Thank you.
You know, we never got the, we were trying to get scenes from the WFMU movie, and no one ever sent us in any scenes. But we're at some point, we're hoping that you'll send us like a scene
so that we
can act it out. Me and Naomi. I could be someone. She could be someone here in the WFMU movie. We're joined today by radio mastermind, radio superstar, Sean Cole is with us today.
Hello.
Sean, I can't believe I've gotten you on this program. This is now I know we've made it as
a
program.
It's my honor and privilege.
Sean is my friend. He's a terrific radio guy, and he's here to talk about, you know, we tried to come up with a new challenge here on the two thumbs up. What is it, three thumbs up? How many thumbs? It's five thumbs up today because Sean's going to talk about his five. Are these your favorite movies, or these are the movies you could think of when we
both.
First?
Both, yeah. They're probably my favorite five.
How many times have you seen these movies?
I think I might have seen the last waltz possibly more than Martin Scorsese has seen it.
Okay, well, that's possible. He was on a lot of cocaine when he made that movie.
I watch it every time I'm cooking, for one thing.
Really?
It's a concert movie. I didn't know if it counted because it's a concert movie.
I think it counts.
And I would I would say I'm just gonna put it on the background and then you know Joni Mitchell comes on and I was just like I have to watch Joni Mitchell and then Van Morrison comes on I have to watch Van Morrison.
Van Morrison's unbelievable.
You know,
there's a few misconceptions I had about some of these movies. So the five movies that we're talking about today, and then when Micah comes in, we'll speak about his movie. It's The Warriors, The Last Waltz, Atlantic City, Wild at Heart, and Boys in the Band, which I've seen four of five of those, and I didn't see Boys in the Band because I looked up the wrong Boys in the Band movie. We're going to talk about that a little bit, too. First, we're going to go down the list. So The Warriors is going to be first. Call 201-209-9368. If you have something interesting, compelling, if you want to join in our chat about The Warriors. Now, I thought, Sean.
Yes.
The Warriors was like, I've only seen before the other day. I'd only seen bits and pieces of The Warriors, and I thought it was like a dystopian future show.
No. It's based on a Greek myth, I think, but the plot of it is so smart. Actually, the idea that the most powerful gang in New York City has, they have this great idea, and they call a caucus of all of the band of all of the gangs.
I had never seen that scene before.
That's great.
Do they call it a conclave or something?
Something like that. And it was like we all meet in Central Park, no guns allowed. And then Cyrus makes this announcement of like, oh, if we all become one gang, we can beat the cops.
I'm like if this guy gets what he wants, it's going to be a very short movie.
I'm serious.
Something about it. For me, I was like, something bad's gonna happen here. But I thought it was like, I thought it was New York, but a New York that was like a dystopian.
No, it's a real
show. Apparently, it's just like a depiction of New York in the 70s
that
like I hadn't really experienced before.
Yes,
which was super fascinating. It's based on the novel, and it's. These guys sort of like have like vests on.
They're a tribe.
Yeah,
they have this
like
sort of like tribal chic thing going on, and then you meet all of these other gangs. So then somebody shoots. This isn't really spoiling anything. Somebody shoots Cyrus as he's speaking, and they blame it on the Warriors. And then the Warriors have to get from Central Park to their home.
I think it's the Bronx. They start in the Bronx, and then they go down the West Side because they're in Riverside Park for a while,
right.
And then
they have to get to the ocean.
They're trying to get to 14th Street and then eventually down all the way down to Coney Island.
Coney Island.
If you've blacked out like me on the subway, then you know. like sometimes you're just going to wake up and you're in Coney Island. You have no idea how you got there kind of thing.
But I was going to say that like I was just like, why hasn't anybody actually tried to do this to get all the gangs together to beat the cop? And it was just like, oh, because what happens exactly next is that the whole thing falls apart.
They said, don't bring any weapons. And the one guy with the weapon is the guy who, you know, like is going to change the thing, but it was super. I mean, there's a lot of sort of wonderful New York in the 70s movies, but like some of the detail of the subway and
all the gangs,
the parks. Well, there was like a mime gang or
something
like
that.
Yeah,
there was a mime gang with the baseball bats. There's
there
a,
was
there's
like
a roller
dudes
skating
from
gang.
The Gap. Like there was just like guys with a cocky shirt and like
and then
like
the Lizzies,
jeans.
The female gang.
They were the toughest. Yeah, I mean they were like
they almost won the day.
Armed to the teeth,
getting the Warriors. Everybody's trying to kill the Warriors.
Someone's saying it's based on the Odyssey. Is that correct?
It's based on the Odyssey. That's what it is. Yes,
that's based
on the Odyssey. And one of my favorite aspects of it is the radio aspect of the.
Oh, that's some great. That's a great DJ there.
Yeah, and it's Lynn Thigpen.
Oh, really?
Who was, what is she, Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego?
Didn't oh, she host really? That That's show? I thought I recognized that voice.
And they only ever show her lips and the microphone, and she's like this person.
But like, it's sort of like letting the other, so like everyone's listening to the radio and the thing, and it's like, we're still looking for the Warriors, you got to go find them.
It's partly a movie about how important radio is.
I feel like it's a movie about how big some things can be in New York that aren't like other places, because it's like... that radio aspect, like there's those weekends where, like, you know, it feel like when Prince dies or something like that, you're going to like every bodega is playing Prince,
right?
Or you feel connected by this sort of like baseline music that's being played around or whatever like that.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I found this movie fascinating. I mean, I found it sort of campy at times.
Very campy. There's a lot of, a little upsetting. There's some stuff that's really like...
There's a lot of handsy sort of inappropriateness.
Well, and there's one guy who really, he tries to make, you know, he tries to assault essentially this woman who turns out to be a cop, and she handcuffs him. Or if she's not a cop, she's a vigilante who's just like out to...
She seems like she's with the cops. And then I was fascinated because he's handcuffed to a city bench and then just starts like picking it up and dragging it with him for a while until... And it also shows the cops are always are very much depicted as like just another gang.
Yeah,
like they're basically like as bad as any of these other gangs. They're just like have like you know, like clubs and stuff like that. But they're like chasing them on the subway, and there's like obviously like the subways didn't work then either. Like that seems like that
and
checks out.
And there's a lot of turnstile jumpers also back then. Very topical.
I was curious how that was going to be covered, and they were really a lot easier to jump back then. Now they have you seen the little serrated? They have these things where if you try to do it in some places. They have like little, you know, like when the pigeons try to sit on something.
Yeah,
and there's
I have
spikes.
Not encountered that yet.
I saw that today, and there's paddles. So there's paddles on the turnstile, and then there's like, you'll cut your hands.
You're
in
making
half.
These.
There's like a bagel slicer.
You're making these hand movements as though you're about to say. And then there's eagles and vultures.
There's eagles and vultures that come out of nowhere.
On top.
I mean, how much is it to ride the subway these days?
There's a subway scene that actually moved me to tears when I was describing it live on stage at a radio event, because the head of the Warriors and his girlfriend are looking across the subway car at these kids who are going to the prom.
And they were sort of like all dusty and like
well, they were
been rolling
up,
around.
But oh, you mean the Warriors? Yeah, the Warriors are all dusty. Like, and then these prom kids are all like dolled up and the woman tries to smooth her hair and her boyfriend like grabs her hand and pulls it down and is like, no, you're not, they're not better than you. Like, you're just as good as they are. And without any dialogue. And I was on stage describing it and I started weeping in front of 400 people.
Well, that makes sense. I think this Warriors movie does bring out a lot in all of us. Now, I've only lived in the New York area for 20 years. You and I were roommates for a while. So you've been a big part of
Bushwick.
My New York experience.
Yeah.
But like, I don't know. There is something so different about like the idea that the Bronx and Coney Island are in the same town is sort of wild.
It
right?
is wild.
Because like, it's like a really like.
It feels like they're in different states.
There's like instead of like being in a place that has like 5 or 10, you know, parts of town, there's like 20,000 parts of New York.
Yeah.
Right? Like where you're just like everyone's got a little piece of the pie here or whatever.
Yeah, there's like there's at least 25 different New York cities in New York City, if not more.
And there was just deep respect between like people based on reputation.
Yeah.
In the things like where a lot of the sort of roving bands of street gangs, like you were just it was just all and there's no internet back there to be like, oh yeah, check us out on Instagram hashtag the Warriors. Like it was just based on, oh, I've heard of you guys. You guys are bad news or whatever. Like you guys are, you know, running Coney Island like real tough or whatever like that.
Well, and there was that other gang at the very, very end.
Those dudes rolled up. Yeah, they roll up on the beach and there's like a scene at the very end where they, you know, people have been chasing the Warriors and they maybe track them down in their own neighborhood or whatever like that. And it's like this, yeah, like this sort of big group suddenly shows up and they're just like, there's a million of them.
Yeah, they're bigger and tougher than any other gang. They're and just, they figure out who actually shows
up. Obviously,
fires.
Hand of God showing up
exactly.
to like, the, you know, decide. And then they sort of decide based on, you know, like, well, we've
I think
heard
they,
your
they,
side.
They got information.
We've
Somebody
heard
witnessed.
Your side. Yeah.
They got tipped. And so Yeah. I feel like we're a bit spoiling the ending, but like in case you haven't seen it, but it came out a long time ago.
50 years. 201-209-9368. Please dial carefully. 201-209-9368. I'm with Sean Cole. This is Three Thumbs Up with Jim the Poet. We are talking about Sean Cole's five favorite movies. I'm super interested in The Warriors. I really did expect something a little bit different. It was campy at times. It was funny at times. It was sort of cartoonishly violent at times. Yeah. There was some real violence, too. I mean, like people waving bats around. And
Yeah. It was scary at times. I remember first seeing it, I was like, what's going to happen? It's like, you know, is there going to be blood? But there's like... Yeah,
I don't remember that much. But people sort of just vanished, like they were just sort of disappeared by the cops at certain points, and it was like. But I don't know. There's something about New York depicted in movies where things were obviously much more grand and worked better at a different time. This kind of goes into the next movie that I want to talk about with you. I thought there was a lot of sort of combination here. You know, the second movie that you mentioned was Atlantic City. That's Louis Malle, which I knew nothing about this film.
Yeah.
Based on John Guare's stuff. And that's Burt Lancaster, Susan Sarandon, cast of a million. But like Atlantic City as a place, now this is in 1980. Atlantic City as a place has always been to me like, what did this place used to look like back in the day? You know, like I saw Boardwalk Empire and stuff like that. That's sort of like Nucky Johnson stuff. That's like early whatever. But like this is sort of 1980s Atlantic City, you know, and like sort of older gangster guy, sort of just barely hanging on to.
Yeah, he's down at the heels himself. He's taking care of an old woman who's ill. He lives across from Susan Sarandon, who is a fishmonger essentially or whatever. She's a waitress at like a fish counter at the casino, but wants to learn how to deal cards and is taking classes to learn how to be a dealer.
That's her dream, right? To like, she wants to be a dealer. She wants to go to like Vegas or Monte Carlo.
She wants to go overseas and try to like deal her way across Europe essentially. And this, you know, the movie, and it's like a problematic movie in ways. It's beautiful. I mean, it's Louis Malle. But like it begins with in this very pervy way with Burt Lancaster kind of like peering in on Susan Sarandon as she's putting lemon juice on herself, and you're not
That's
sure
the very
why
first
it
scene of the movie. She's like bent over the kitchen sink and sort of like, you know, takes her top off a little bit and is like, you know, like she's got lemons
and she's slicing lemons and squeezing them on
her
arms.
This whole thing, and he's sort of like just looking in and being like enamored with this sort of beautiful young, you know, Susan Sarandon, but also sort of, I think, perplexed by, like, what exactly is going
on
here.
Why are you using lemons?
What is happening here?
What's going on?
But, like, Atlantic City's a big backdrop of the thing where they're showing buildings sort of, like, being broken down and fading to the... Which is how you might think about Atlantic City for the last 40 years.
It's a crumbling Atlantic City. And there's a building imploded, I think, at one point.
Right.
And then Susan Sarandon's husband and her sister, who have gotten together, just show up at her job at one point, and you come to learn that the husband left her for the sister, and now they're like they need a place to stay or whatever, and the husband intercepts a drug drop. Again, it's like before the internet, it's before cell phones. So like, you know, it's at a time when pay phones were essential devices, and both for making calls, but also for leaving cocaine up in the like top lip of the shelf so that you could like put the cocaine there and somebody comes and they get it, and he intercepts it and starts.
And then sort of like has a plan. Like he's a man with a plan. He's come from Canada. Like
he's a total derelict.
They were dressed in weirdly hippie sort of like, you know, knit clothes and stuff like that. And he's obviously, he's got some issues with Susan Sarandon as his ex-whatever.
Well, and he's manipulative. He, like, steals from her at one point.
And he plays upon Burt Lancaster's sort of sense of self where he says, like, oh, I've heard you're the guy to talk to in Atlantic. Yeah. Sort of meets him by accident and sort of, like, you know, is like, I heard you're the guy to talk to in Atlantic City. And he's like,
did so-and-so tell you that?
I have a reputation. Yeah, did you talk to this guy? You know,
it's like, oh, yeah,
Skunky
what's that
John
guy?
Yeah, like, yeah, oh, yeah, exactly. Skunky John said great, you know, whatever his name was. I can't say the guy's name, his guy's, you know, mob name on the over the air. But like that was one of the things that the woman he sort of takes care
That's
of
right.
threw at him one time. That is, her husband had a name Cookie something or other like that, and she's like, "Your nickname. Everybody else had cool nicknames, and yours was you know
bleep bleep bleep." Yeah, yeah. Meaning that he was a wimp. I mean, like, that's the thing, is he had these sort of, like, grand ideas of who he used to be and who he was in the world of the mob or of, you know, like, tough guys back in the day. And he really wasn't that. But he thinks he was, and he's like, maybe I still can be. And then...
because he says it at one point. He's, like, trying to make himself look cooler to this boyfriend, husband guy... and to the Susan Sarandon. And then, like, at some point, things, you know, sort of get out of control in this movie. And I think he's surprised and sort of, on the one hand, he initially is sort of let down by himself and his own self-image, but then sort of, like, goes, I've suddenly become the person I've always said I was.
The hero.
And it was, like, it was such an interesting sort of journey for Burt Lancaster there in the thing. I mean, he obviously, like, was a beautiful actor, a really handsome-looking guy and stuff like that. It's a sort of a super interesting role for him at the very end. And it sort of mirrors the sort of background of where it really looked like it had been shot in Atlantic City in different places. I didn't look it up. But, I mean, like, they sort of evoked the town in a sort of smart way.
Yeah.
I don't know. I found it super interesting. I found it super...
It's gorgeous. I mean, Louis Malle is just such an incredible filmmaker, and he even makes, like, the violent, gritty... You know, I mean, there's two killings in the movie, and then they somehow both just, like... They're just really evocative visually.
Well, there's that one where he's climbing up, like, an elevated parking... Like, I had never seen of that view where the sort of guy is, like... He's, like, trying to get away from these, you know, thugs... And the young
from
guy
from whom he stole the cocaine.
And the guy is just climbing through, like, you know, one of those things where you park your car and then they bring it up to six levels or something like that. And it's just like those are going up and down. And it's sort of super interesting, super well shot.
Yeah, it was an interesting idea on the part of Louis Malle to be like, to look at an object like that and be like, oh, I know what
I'm
doing.
Oh,
we
got to use this for, you know. I don't know. I found it like both of these movies on. You know, Warriors was maybe a second viewing or a second and a one and a half viewing. Atlantic City totally had no idea about, had to Google it, had to go find it, whatever like that. Highly recommend. Big chef's kiss for both of these movies. I mean...
All three of your thumbs are up?
Both of the thumbs and the other thumb is up. Try to keep all your thumbs in the air.
Try to keep all your thumbs in the air.
The number is 201-209-9368. You can call now. 201-209-9368. We're switching over to David Lynch. So, David Lynch. Now, my experience with David Lynch, this is the first, Wild at Heart is the first movie I saw of his in the theater, for sure. It came out, like, I don't know exactly if it came out before I knew about Twin Peaks. Or subsequently, or like Twin Peaks was on the air and was like the biggest hit in the world.
Yeah.
And then this came out that summer. And I was like, well, this is amazing. I got to check this out. And it's, I'm not sure it's my favorite David Lynch
movie. Oh, I see.
Because it's like based on a book, which Barry Gifford, like his books used to be super famous and stuff like that. But like, I actually liked it more on this viewing that I did last night.
What do you think the difference was?
Well, his own movies are so, I mean, when he writes the movies, like David Lynch movies are like all over the road. And so super crazy, super amazing. Like half the time I'm like, what's going on? Half the time I'm asleep. Half the time I'm like, I don't know who's who.
It's
I don't
three
know.
Halves.
Yeah, there's a lot of halves in a lot of David Lynch movies. This one is sort of more of like a screenplay. And like he wrote the screenplay. He was going to produce this film. And I think then he decided to direct it for some reason. And I love Nicolas Cage. Nicolas Cage is like allegedly my second or third cousin or something like that for some reason.
Oh, that's right.
We're trying to get him on the air. We haven't had any luck. But Nicolas Cage is sort of amazing in a Nicolas Cage kind of
Sailor
way in this
Ripley.
One. And Laura Dern is just like this.
Laura Dern is Laura Dern.
She's just you can't take your eyes off her.
She can do no wrong.
But it's like there's a lot of Wizard of Oz, Elvis stuff that I think on the first viewing when I saw it in 1990 or whatever, I was sort of like, it's a bit cliched. It's a bit like there's a lot of this out there kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And there's a lot less sort of Elvis impersonator, Wizard of Ozzy. Like, we don't, although, you know, I mean, there's some Wizard of Oz stuff out there, but it's not quite as heavy-handed as it seemed at that time.
Well, it's funny because it ends with, you know, like, I guess I've never been so sold on the ending. I forgive it because I just love the rest of the movie in a way that is kind of embarrassing. Like, it might not just be my favorite Lynch movie. I think it might be my favorite movie.
Really?
I think it might be. But, like, and then the ending where, like, you know, the Good Witch is, it's almost like,
well,
click your heels and all
that
stuff.
I had forgot about that part. That's Cheryl Lee. So, like, obviously, like, the Twin Peaks troupe is in this.
Yes, right.
Like, at a certain point, you're like, okay, we've checked the boxes. Almost the entire cast is in this movie. But in lesser roles and stuff like that. And
but
she plays Glinda.
It's reminiscent of another movie I love that wasn't, this didn't make the list for some reason, but it could easily, which is My Own Private Idaho. And the way ends is also heavy-handed in a way because it's supposed to be like, you know, this Shakespearean thing, and he's reciting lines from Shakespeare, and you're just like, okay, you know, kind of, it's just like, did you just like run out of things to say, so you needed to crib these lines? But like, but the rest of the movie is so compelling that you're just like, well, I don't, you know, I would sit through the credits twice of this if I had to.
Well, I had forgotten about the ending because part of the thing that David Lynch changed about the book was the ending. He didn't like the ending of the book and wanted to do something else. And so there's sort of a false ending, and then an interaction happens. And then, yeah, like sort of like it, a much more like sensible sort of ending, because you're like, the first hour of the movie is really just like, there's a lot of repetitive, these guys are in bed together, it's their chemistry's off the charts, it's all hotness and all that kind of
stuff. There's a lot of hotness and a lot of sex.
And then it's like the second hour is more like things are sort of fraying apart, they're falling over. These two are sort of on the run.
Well,
and
her mother doesn't want her to
Diane
be a
Ladd
sailor.
Unbelievable. I mean, is that her real mom, I think. I mean, it might be.
Is that true?
I think it's Laura Dern's real mom.
And
people on the boards could let me know, because I... frequently wrong.
Didn't want her to be with Sailor, and so has hired an assassin to try to...
Not just one, you know, like a team of assassins, it seems like, at certain points. An incredible performance by Willem Dafoe, who... That scene is the one I remember.
That's a great scene.
We just like, this is insane.
Yeah.
I had forgotten Crispin Glover was in this.
Oh, I had forgotten that, too.
And Isabella Rossellini.
Yeah.
And, sort of, and, you know, like, Harry Dean Stanton is sort of, like,
yeah,
great. I mean, literally... It's like the entire cast that, like, hey, we're doing a movie over here. Can the entire cast of Twin Peaks come over here and do it with us for, like, a day?
Yeah.
And then we're going to go back to, like, you know, it's just going to be Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern making out for, like, we're not even filming that part. We're just going to have them make out. You
but
know?
Again, and I think a thing that it has in common with the Warriors and with Atlantic City is that the acting is, like, really stylized. Like, it's, like, there's this kind of, like, you know, like, magical realism. Like, people don't really talk or act this way. 'Cause I'm also, like, a big fan of David Mamet for that reason. And, like, it's just, like, I feel like, yeah, I could watch, and I do like a lot of, you know, hyper-real movies where it just seems like, you know, I like a lot of mumblecore movies, like a lot of movies where people just seem like they're hanging around talking, but there's something about, like, just this way in which, you know, like somebody, the artful way in which somebody is embodying a character and the way that they're written, that it's just like you don't meet those people and they don't say those things in real life. It feels like
when you're entering a language universe, or you're entering like a new, like when you go to a Mamet thing, things are written in a way where it's like you're in the middle of something and like half of it's not explained to you, and a lot of things are happening off stage that never even occur to you or whatever.
And it's
like
the same way with some of the like a lot of the poetry that I like. It's like, oh, people don't talk that way, you know, like they're
but that you've created your more, own sort of vocal universe.
Yes, your own idiolect.
Hello, Carl, you're on the air. This is Jim the Poet and Sean Cole.
Oh, is this me?
Yes, this is you. Hello, welcome to the program.
Hi, guys. The reason I called, because you were discussing Wild at Heart, and then you also mentioned My Private Idaho,
mm-hmm.
and I worked on both of those films.
Oh, my goodness.
Thank you for your service.
The craziest scene in Wild at Heart is we're filming at the Palomino in North Hollywood, the famous country western club.
Mm-hmm.
It's the heavy metal scene.
Oh, yes.
Hey, wow.
That's out there and does the Elvis.
Yeah.
So David Lynch stops everything and says, everybody, follow me. And it's dusk, you know, pink sky, all that stuff. We march down a closed Lancashire Boulevard about a half a block and watch a building burn together.
Oh.
Oh, my God.
And then we go back to work.
It's just like, I want to show you something down the street here.
That's
yeah, exactly.
So...
You know, and then I worked with, I actually played the, in my own private Idaho when the guys are getting ripped off in the park.
Yes.
They're dressed up.
Yeah.
Oh. I'm the lead rock promoter.
Look at you.
And the crazy thing is that I go back to L.A. and I get a phone call and they say, hey, dude, do you want to go to Rome and work on the film in Rome for 2 weeks? So that was really a,
that was filmed in
so that's
Rome.
That's why I moved the call up, because I don't ever get to break out my
my previous world. Regarding Wild at Heart, there's the scene that's a super interesting sequence where they're in a hotel room. She's doing her toenails, and they sort of like she starts dancing on the bed, and suddenly like it fades into that bar. And there's like a super heavy metal sort of rocky dance, and they're dancing.
We actually, David Lynch actually, I had a little rock band at the time. We actually did some fake speed metal tracks for that production, and my partner sent it to me about 4 or 5 years ago. I'm like, wow, we were pretty good.
I thought it was, of course,
we didn't get the gig. There were some, I think, Canadian band.
I see. So was it actually them playing, or you're saying it was like they were physically acting like they were playing, but you overdubbed music on top of?
That was actually my gig at that thing, was doing playback.
I was operating playback.
Nicolas Cage is like not just sort of moshing. He's like karate chopping his way through.
Right. And also during that same scene, the crowd wasn't quite getting into it.
Mm.
And this guy named Johnny Angel from Boston had moved out to L.A. that day. And he's one of the extras, and he doesn't know anything about being on a film set. So he walks up to David Lynch and he says, hey, and he gets on the ground and he starts doing the worm. Right? And the crowd and the rest of the dancers all go nuts. And then we really got the production really got rolling.
Wow.
Well, it's an amazing scene, an amazing sequence.
I thought I'd chime in.
Thank you so much for chiming.
Thank you very much for the call. 201-209-9368, where you've been discussing The Warriors, Atlantic City, Wild at Heart. But that's a pretty great way to sort of button up our Wild at Heart. Although have you gone back and seen any David Lynch films in the last few months?
Yes, I saw Blue Velvet for the first time ever.
You saw it on the big screen?
No, I saw it on TV. I had a friend over, and she was, and it was like, it's the kind of friend, my dear, dear, dear friend, Sarah, who I hope is listening and probably isn't, but anyway, she loves this movie so much that she'll begin to recite it as it's happening.
Wow.
And she was like, I can't believe you've never seen it. You have to see it. And and I didn't really, sort of like you with Atlantic City, and I didn't know what to expect at all. And was kind of surprised, I think, by the degradation. I don't know why.
Well, it's funny. I went back and watched Siskel and Ebert reviews of, because Siskel is like, this is great. This is obviously one of the best movies of the year. And Ebert's like, something happens in this film that goes beyond what films should do. I felt bad for this actress and couldn't get over it. They actually used to have programs. I mean, I used to love watching Siskel and Ebert, because even if you don't watch the movies, it's fun to watch them fight
or argue about things
or whatever. And, like, they went back and looked at it later. You know, like, they came back on at, like, the very end of the year, and they were like, we're doing a show about all the mistakes we made this year, the stuff that we said wasn't any good that was obviously pretty good. And Ebert just never got over this thing. And it actually colored a lot of his David Lynch sort of reviews over into the years.
That's interesting.
Because he said he was taking advantage of the actress in a way that, like, shouldn't have happened, and he felt embarrassed. And he's like, well, they're, like, married. So, like, I don't know what you think has happened here. But, like, it's obviously, like, for me, I don't know. I love David Lynch films. We recently, before David Lynch died, like a week before, me and a couple of the people from Why Do We Only Listen to Dead People, the classical music show that's on Sundays, went and saw Racerhead, which I've seen a million times.
Couldn't watch it.
I fall asleep every time.
I didn't fall asleep. I was 15 years old, and I was with a girlfriend in the basement of my parents' home.
Yeah.
And we were, like, you know, supposed to be making out or whatever. And I guess the pre-foreplay was watching Eraserhead. And she looked at me at one point. We had got to the scene where the girl is sort of stepping back and forth on stage and slugs start to fall from the ceiling and she's squishing them. And the girl looks at me and goes, "Are you all right?" And and I said, "Could we turn this off?" And she goes, "You've gone white." And I was like, "Yeah, I don't think we should watch this." So I've never seen the whole thing. Maybe I could get through it now.
I recommend seeing it on the big screen. I mean, it's interesting to see it with a crowd, I think. I mean, my thing was always, I was such a big fan of Twin Peaks. I was introduced to Twin Peaks by in reruns after it was already a hit.
Interesting.
And so, like, it was on the cover of Rolling Stone, which I used to get. And I was like, boy, this must be a pretty good show. I'll check it out. And so I watched it in reruns over the summer, that first season, when it was sort of like a colossal hit. And ABC goes, "Oh, you got to wrap up this murder." And they're like, "We're never going to do that. Like, I don't know why you think that's something we should do. That's the whole point of the show. That's, like, our whole idea." And they're like, "Yeah. Nope, wrap it up. 4 episodes, get rid of it. Get, you know, get moving, keep moving on to the next thing." And I was so interested in that balance of David Lynch and Mark Frost was the other producer, where it was sort of like one guy definitely seemed to know that they lived in the real world. And then there's David Lynch, who's like, the more you see the David Lynch episode, you're just like, what on earth is happening here?
Yeah.
Like, some of the most amazing television I've ever seen. And that had been on like, national broadcast. Like,
it was shocking.
Primetime TV.
Yeah, that it was primetime TV.
You're just like, what on earth is happening in this show?
I didn't see a lot of it. I saw some of it and, like, super enjoyed what I saw, particularly, like, the early episodes of, you know, where Kyle MacLachlan's, like, arriving in the town and he's, like, really,
yeah, I mean,
you know,
incredible.
Obsessed with cherry pie or whatever. And, again, like, super, you know, hyper-real, you know, acting and writing. And yeah, it was – I was impressed with whoever greenlit that show for primetime.
I mean, just incredible. And I think you used to be able to have more fun on TV and do different stuff.
Well, you can now again. I mean,
well, I wonder. Yeah, I mean, well, they did the Showtime thing, which was like, wow, this is like David Lynch minus Mark Frost. And there's, I don't know if you've seen the sort of Twin Peaks, The Return and stuff like that.
I haven't yet.
There
no.
was a lot of, you're waiting around a lot for something to happen.
But I mean, now
and some amazing, I mean, also some, there was like 2 maybe amazing things I'd never seen on television before
yeah.
that like are in that too. But
I feel like there's a lot of fun, wild experimentation happening on TV. I mean, I'm not the first person who said this. And like the most recent example that I can think of, which I feel like is quite Lynchian, is Severance. And similar to like, you know, we better wrap up this murder and say who did it. You know, now that I won't say what happens, but at the end of the second season, you learn a thing that is sort of integral to the entire show.
Right.
And now there's going to be a third season. And I'm like, what are they going to do?
Well, yeah, I'm not sure. It's probably going to take them a while. But, I mean, my feeling about some of the – even that prestige TV stuff is the episodes that are directed by Ben Stiller are obviously like, okay, I'm going to probably have to watch this one twice and see if I get everything or whatever. Like,
yeah, yeah.
And then there's other episodes where they're like, we're just kind of kicking the soccer ball down the hill, and then we'll go get it, and then we'll, this is like another episode.
What a soccer ball, though.
Well, it's a very interesting program.
I love that show. That might be my favorite show. I like that I'm living in a time – where I'm at this age and like every new show that I get obsessed with, I was like, no, this is my favorite TV show of all time.
Well, it is.
No, this is my favorite TV show.
It is fun to think that
time.
Like we haven't yet experienced everything cool we're ever going to experience, and some things are still going to knock us out, whether it's a movie or songs or
yeah,
you know,
not
that kind
good
of thing.
Anyway.
I hope so. I mean, it's. I mean, there were times where like it just seemed like there was nothing good on. Nobody was talking
Absolutely.
About anything.
Absolutely.
What else do we got? Oh, let's talk about The Last Waltz. I didn't know much about the band
no.
when I first saw The Last Waltz. I think John Mulroney, because John Mulroney wasn't living in I used to live in Alston, part of Boston, where I think everybody who's lived in Boston has to live in Alston at some point.
Alston, Rock City.
You live with like 7 or 8 roommates and 2 bands, and there's like 15 couches downstairs.
Behind the Star Market.
It was behind the Star Market. We were across from where the nuns lived, dude. And so like He at one point we're watching this thing, and it's obvious that I should know more about the band
or not.
I was watching it the first time, and like the thing that knocks me out about the thing that I think is the height of this movie for me is still the helpless with Neil Young who comes out covered in cocaine.
Yeah, he's got a big rock in his nose,
and like is singing the song where somehow she's backstage singing and you know
Johnny
isn't invited on.
Like, no, I think I don't know.
Let
I
her be on stage.
It was supposed to be like some
she's
sort
some
of,
unearthly voice from beyond,
this
or
angelic
whatever.
Ethereal.
But
voice.
I just didn't know very much about the you know first of all the Canadian sort of like. And it's kind of country rock, which at the time when I first saw it, I was like, well, these guys aren't the Pixies. Should I even like these guys? But now, I mean, obviously, it's like there's just a ton of great music. It's really well shot. The interviews that they're sort of interspersed with Scorsese, you know, he's interviewing members of the band. They're all sort of joking around and feeling pretty drunk and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't think of another concert movie that I've seen that I thought was as good as this.
I can't think of one either. I mean, maybe Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, but this one is—it's for one thing, it feels like it's more than a concert movie. It's not quite a narrative feature film, and it's not quite a documentary. But it's sort of like a hybrid of all of them, especially concert movie and documentary. And just the way it's structured is so smart and makes me feel. Like, oh, that's what editing is, because of course he figures out that the last song that they played, I'm getting chills thinking about this, that the last song that they played in their last concert that they did ever was the most dramatic part of the film, and that it should actually go first.
It's at the beginning.
Yeah, and they're in different outfits than they are in the rest of the movie,
right? Because
they've gone backstage to change. But you don't know that it's the last song yet until they finish.
And they're like, bye,
and
see ya.
Like,
that's this is the end of the concert or whatever.
Goodbye, yeah.
No, I mean, there's some great sort of external stuff of San Francisco that I love, mm-hmm. sort of the, you know, like where they were playing. And I don't know. I just, I'm not an aficionado of their band. You know, I should know a lot. I'm here on WFMU. We all know everything about music except me. And so I didn't think they were a fake band like Spinal Tap, but I was like, when I first saw them, I was like, so these are the guys that play with Dylan? Oh,
they
okay, that's kind of cool.
And that's how they got the name. And they were the Hawks. They were Ronnie Hawkins.
Yeah,
band.
Well, he comes on and
he
sings
comes
at
on
one
first.
Point. I mean, they sing with Dr. John, which I think is cool. Like, I love Dr. John.
Love Dr. John. They sing with Muddy Waters.
Somebody says Stop Making Sense. That's also a great.
Yeah, that's
which
that's
I
true.
Would love
yes,
to
yes,
see
yes.
that again.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
there's a
yeah.
lot of you know sort of like wonderful stuff there with the dancing.
You're doing the
I'm doing
worm
the,
right now.
I'm doing.
Well, you're like wearing a big suit.
I got
suit.
The big suit and you know.
You got
like,
a big suit on.
Yeah, I mean that's a good one too, Mark. Thank you for chiming in.
That's very true.
201-209-9368. We're talking about Sean Cole's. Are these your five favorite films?
They were the five that
the
burbled
five
to
that
the top of my consciousness.
Because it's like, you know, I mean, when I say my favorite films, like
it's
if
hard.
I'm trying to impress people, you know, I say like,
yeah, exactly.
well, you know, Red, Blue, White from Kieslowski. Or, you try to make up. If you're at a party, you make up like a French movie. It was like, well, there was one by Pierre Jean. You know, they're being like, no, I'm not familiar with this. Oh, he has one called Merci Beaucoup. And it's like a lot of smoking and it's black and white and they're shooting at each other or whatever. But like this is a sort of a wide variety of sort of different kinds of things. It's not like
or
one
I think
thing
there.
After another.
I think a bunch of them are of kind of a time. And there's also like there was one that was on the list, but then when I thought it was like, oh, what am I talking about? Wild of Heart. So I displaced it, called Freebie and the Bean, which I can't defend as a movie because it's so dated in a lot of problematic ways. But it's James Caan and Alan Arkin, and it's a buddy cop movie, and is. Just one of the funniest things I've ever seen, even with all of the awful stereotyping that's in there. And like a car goes into a building and, you know, I can't remember the name of the actress, the woman who played Rhoda.
Rhoda.
Yeah, her. is Alan Arkin's wife, and there's this whole like subplot where she's like cheating on him. It's just like it's such a great film. But
it's
like
Valerie Harper,
thank you very much. And so that one, and then, so it used to be that when people asked me what my favorite films were, I would say that one, and I would say The Bedsitting Room, which was an old British comedy film, I think from the 60s or early 70s. And again, the conceit is very simple. where a nuclear bomb has gone off and there are something like 50 people left living in the United Kingdom. And it's this post-apocalyptic movie featuring Harry Secombe, Spike Milligan. It was Peter Cook and Dudley Moore's first appearance on film.
Oh, wow.
John Gielgud is in it. And, you know, like, there's, like, radiation everywhere.
Those are the 50
everywhere.
People? Like, those are the...
Yeah, those are the great 50 people. And you know, there's all this radiation everywhere. So, like, there's, like, a person, one of the sub... There's many subplots, and one of them is that there's a man who is in the process of turning into a bed-sitting room. And he, like, he'll, like, have a drawer coming out of it. And it's, like, so surrealistic. And he's also like, a bed-sitting room, really? I couldn't be a penthouse. I couldn't be like, you know, kind of a thing.
It's a metaphor.
Yeah. So that was but for some reason, I think it's because it's been a long time since I've seen it. So I didn't.
Well, the fifth movie, which I didn't get a chance to watch, is called Boys in the Band. William Friedkin, I didn't realize he was the director. Now, yeah. When I initially looked up Boys in the Band, there's one by the guy who does Sheldon. That just came out.
Yeah, like Jim
Parsons. Who I think is delightful. And
he's a great actor.
He's done some wonderful things on Broadway, and I think they did Broadway, and then they did. But this is a version that's from the 70s or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
This is Cliff Gorman.
I don't recognize any of the actors, I have to say.
Well, Dominic Dunn is in it. Mark Crowley. So this is a tale of a gay 70s.
It's the great thing about this movie. So it began as a play. And the great thing about it is that it all happens in one place and it happens in real time. So a little bit like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, as a movie, there's like a little bit of cheating of that because it's a movie and people are worried that like, oh, it's just going to be boring if they just like watch a group of people in the same place for the same length of time. But it's a birthday party and it's a band of gay men who are all very good friends. And then the host, Michael, the host of the birthday party, gets a call from his college roommate who's in complete crisis and is like, I need to see you and I need to see you tonight. He's like, tonight's a little bit bad.
Yeah, I mean, I got to have something going on, right?
The college roommate doesn't know that Michael is gay. They haven't seen each other in a long time. And he calls him Mickey and he's like, Mickey, please. You know, I have to see you. And he's like, oh, okay. So he goes out to the rest of the guests at the party and is like, I have my straight college roommate coming over. He has a problem. We're just going to talk for 20 minutes. Act like you're not gay. And hijinks ensue.
Hijinks ensue. Upper East Side, 1968 Manhattan. And there's it's just a big gang of lovable characters?
Yeah, and they kind of love each other. They rib each other. There's friction between a couple of them. One of them is this couple, these two men who are a couple lovers and they're having relationship problems, and one of them had previously been straight and married to a woman and then discovered he was gay late in life, and the other one's a real player. And again, some problematic, you know, like race jokes that are difficult to metabolize nowadays. And also when they redid this movie as a movie and as a play on Broadway recently, they had to like figure out a way that Michael, the main character, says a racial slur without actually you hearing it. So like it was an interesting puzzle. They're like, it's in the script. How do we have him say this? And
you mean the F word? Is that what we're talking about?
The N word.
Oh, the N word's in the movie?
In the movie. And so the most recent remake, they're like, how do we have him say this without?
Because that's kind of the end.
It's the end.
Of you as a character.
Exactly.
Like that's like how to show yourself. Like if you're wearing like a stormtrooper outfit, they know you're a stormtrooper. So like if you say the N-word, that's the sign to the audience that you it's okay to get shot.
Yeah,
you
know, and it's like it's like what they call in radio producing a chicken bomb, where it's just like an item or like a fact or an anecdote in a story where it just like
takes you out of
it. Just takes you out of it completely and distracts from everything else, and then you can't like get back to it somehow. I was just like, how are they going to handle this? And the way they did it in the most recent version is with all of this hubbub, so that you just like you don't hear it because there's so much noise in the room, but you know that he said it, kind of a thing. I don't know the last time you saw The Jerk in. They also use the N-word in The Jerk.
The Jerk, you mean the Steve Martin movie?
The Steve Martin
movie. I haven't
movie.
Seen that in a very long time.
And I had forgotten that.
There
and
was
I
a lot
got
of
to
loose N-words
like,
and a lot of things where you're like, whoa, that word came out of nowhere. Yeah. That is not a thing you should be throwing around.
No, it isn't.
We have a few more minutes. 201-209-9368. Boys in the Band, Warriors,
Last Waltz,
Atlantic City, and Wild at Heart.
And Wild at Heart.
Pretty good five choice. Like, if someone's asked me my five choices, like, at least three of them would be some kind of Star Wars thing.
Really?
Well, I don't know. I mean, like, the Star Wars, seeing Star Wars in the movie theaters with my father and my brother.
The first one.
The first one when I was so young. I was like,
terrifying.
I was like, what on earth is this?
So Jimmy and I are the same age, and it's like, it's hard to describe, like, not knowing what Star Wars was. And really kind of like not knowing what like a city bus is. Like we were so young, but we were able to comprehend things. And there's like monsters in a bar playing, you know, instruments. And there's like a big, you know, like Wookiee
thing. The first 25 minutes, there's no humans, like no human characters. All these droids yelling at you. And they're sort of bickering back and forth. You're like, what on earth is this movie?
And
like,
it's
this
super,
is amazing.
It's super disturbing. And then the next two ones, you're just like, and then you find out that, like, you know, Leia and Luke are siblings.
Well, that feels sort of thrown in, and, you know? I mean, like,
I guess. They made out at one point.
They did
and then
make
they
out
discover,
a bunch
and then,
of times.
And then they discover
that
the
brother and
sister.
It was a lot of kissing.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, like, if I want to sound smart at parties, I say like weird things no one's heard of, or you know, I have
or you make them up.
I have five. Yeah, if you make up stuff at parties, people are like, oh yeah, I saw that at South by Southwest a few years ago. Movie Foot Cannon with you know,
yeah.
Steve Magoo.
Exactly.
I
loved Foot Cannon.
Foot Cannon was that's a keeper for you.
Yeah, that was the sixth on the list.
Couldn't get enough of Foot Cannon. But this movie show is about talking about movies, and a lot of times I feel like I come and I see like 8-10 movies a week, and then it's like no one, you know, everyone wants to call about the dogs that are in movies or, you know, that kind of, which is great. I'm happy to talk about the dogs in movies too, but it's like there is a lot of great stuff happening in theaters, but I feel like I've hit the wall a little bit. You know, I came into this project in May of last year, May and June.
Oh.
And it's just been wall to wall. Like at one point, at the end of the year, it was like I'd seen 150 like 2-hour movies in theaters or something like that. And I was just like, boy, that seems like a lot.
Yeah.
And that seems like a big. Now I don't have a life. I got nobody who loves me kind of thing.
Oh,
I'm not expected
Jimmy.
To be anywhere in any particular time. Which is like you're
love you.
You're thinking like, well, Jim's not hanging out with me, but he's going to see like, damn Minecraft
or
movie
at least
or
you and
like
I you could invite me to the movies.
You could go to the movies with me. I mean, there's plenty of great stuff happening, and it just feels like I don't know. We did the fundraising. I kind of hit the wall a little bit. Then I was off last week. Ask Alan had a very special episode of Ask Alan last week, a very intense after school special version of Ask Alan. Love you, Ask Alan. Thank you so much for all that you do for the station. Hopefully we'll be guests on Ask Alan.
That'd be great.
Because I got a lot of problems I need him to unravel.
I'd like to
for
ask
me.
Alan a lot of things.
Ask Alan is a great program, and so is his other show, 6 Degrees with Alan. It's Micah's time is coming up. Micah has entered the room. You have a second to call, 201-209-9368. You can call about one of our movies or just to say hi. Mike is coming up at the top of the hour with Music and Mind Control. And as always, we reflect on a movie that he has chosen for me and for me alone to share with the audience. And this week's feels particularly WFMU, feels particularly apt. And I'm excited to speak to Mike about it. He's plugging in. I'm looking for, you know, I got to go to Boston this weekend, Sean.
Oh, is that right?
Need anything like a lobster or something?
I'm going.
Like that.
I'm going next week.
Oh, really? For
the whole week? How long are you going to be there? We can talk about this off the air.
Well, I mean, if you see me, I have, you know, it's all Amtrak now for Jimmy. So
I'm driving.
Know, I travel. You know, like
I'm going on Monday. If you need a ride.
Oh, I'm coming back on Monday.
Yeah, okay.
Because I have to see three films Monday night
right,
for next week's show.
Do. Yeah, yeah.
Which I hope you guys will tune into, and I hope you appreciate this program, and I appreciate all that you have given us here at WFMU. This adventure through the movies has been you know, an incredible experience because it, for me. Going to a movie theater, it's dark. You can't play with your phone. You really kind of have to pay attention to things a little bit as opposed to how I watch normal things, where it's like I walk out of the room and then I forget where my pants are, and then I'm like, where, what part of the movie was I in? I got to rewind it a little bit. Did I miss something important, kind of thing? But you're in a theater, you're in the front row, you're sort of overwhelmed by the cinema, as you know.
Who was it in the Oscars, most recent Oscars, who gave this, like...
Oh, Sean Baker from the Enora
movie. Yeah, 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 that's right.
I think he's right. I mean, I think there's a lot of films you would want to see in a theater.
And the theaters are dying, evidently.
Well, maybe. But would you say Micah has joined us? Hello, Micah. Thank you for... This week's Micah's pick is called Reflections of Evil. Now, this is apparently some sort of DIY edited, directed, and not just produced, but like distributed movie that came out... In 2000, it seemed like it was older than that.
Like it's Damon Packard. He made it. It was a passion thing of his. He made it over a long period of time. He basically went bankrupt, combining different stocks of film with digital video, and it's essentially like a journey into. This fantasy reality of his obsession with young Steven Spielberg and I guess it's like a part of him, like an exaggerated part of him, like the Biggest Loser in LA who sells watches on the street.
He's got like 12 layers on. He's obviously like sort of like he's yelling a lot. He's got headphones on sometimes. And he lives
in like the valley with an old Jewish lady whose refrigerator is filled with rotting gefilte fish.
Oh my.
For the holidays. But
and he lives in the living room and he surrounds himself with cereal boxes.
Now the link that you sent me, it was unclear when the movie was beginning because I couldn't tell if it was like an ABC Wednesday night movie of the week.
That's the way
they
made it.
There were ads and stuff like that. That sort of like throughout they sort of come back to this couple that seems to be like they think the main characters invading their home or something like that. And so they're sort of like, call the cops. Why don't you call the cops?
Right. And he's puking.
There's a lot of like chewing noises throughout. Like the chewing is exaggerated in a way that's sort of like completely upsetting.
It sounds like it has resonances with Repo Man a little bit.
Do you think that Repo Man, well, so Repo Man's from the 80s. Do you think Repo Man like influenced this film in some way?
No,
I mean,
this is his own personal obsession with Hollywood, with a sort of bygone era, you know, the whole sort of universal tour, the reality tour of
because he keeps sneaking onto
Hollywood,
sets, right?
And his personal obsession, hatred with Steven Spielberg. At one point... He goes on the Universal Studios tour and takes a ride on the what's that film about the Holocaust that Steven Spielberg made?
Schindler's List.
He goes on the Schindler's List ride.
I didn't know there was a Schindler's List ride.
He's obsessed with how Spielberg made himself known in the industry about. The whole idea is that he has a sister,
right,
who got lost on the Universal Studios tour in 1973, and somehow that's linked with Spielberg's entry into cinema when he first started making Night Gallery episodes, and somehow these things are linked, and he's trying to find.
Because it's unclear what's happening throughout most of this
but
film.
But it's a very gestalt to me. It's like a very gestalt experience. It's like you don't know whether you're dreaming or whether the main character is dreaming or what's real.
I love movies like that.
There's a lot of physical confrontations that sort of come out of nowhere.
Like everybody hates this guy. He's like the biggest, fattest loser in L.A. And this is his story. He has like these images. At one point, it's like he has these this drug trip.
Yeah, like a flashback. A flashback. I'm like, what is happening?
To the Golden Guru with Crosby, Stills, and
well, there was some beautiful. I mean, some of that footage is sort of super beautiful. There's this woman with like 25 arms, sort of going like gesticulating and different. And I'm like, wait a minute, have I clicked off of what I was watching? Because I don't know what's happening.
Anyway,
now.
It's one of my favorite movies of all time. To me, it's like a very deeply personal odyssey. It's non-linear, but it has I don't know, maybe from a Generation X standpoint, it has a lot of resonance.
I mean, it was inspiring because like I've been thinking about watching all these movies. I'm like, maybe I should make a movie or something like that. And this guy sort of like hand to hand, like sent it to every person in Hollywood. Like,
right. And the only person who advocated for him was Jethro Tull, Ian Anderson.
Ian Anderson.
Really?
Love it.
He was and everyone else threw it in the garbage.
They're like, I don't know what this is. Like, I think if you watched 5 minutes of it, you'd be like, I don't know what this is. It's super crazy.
Is it scary? Is it hard? Like,
there's a lot of yelling. There's a lot of like wailing. There's a lot of chewing.
It's a dark
a lot of
comedy.
Vomiting.
It's just a dark, unconventional comedy about like the love of movies.
I mean, I'm glad I watched it, but it's a tough thing to sit through. I mean, I'd be interested to see it on the big screen and if it improved it dramatically or not. But I don't know. I often didn't know what was happening.
You're not supposed to know. Why do you need to know what's happening all the time?
That's a key question.
No, but I mean, like,
that's a very good question.
Which is fine. Like, if you feel like you're in the joke with the guy, but like it felt like often, yeah, it was really like they had thrown a bunch of footage together and sort of strung it along. But I'm fascinated by it. And I the more I read about it, the more I think about it, the more I like it, and it makes me think that I could do such a thing as well. And I think that's
well,
good
now
too.
You could, of course, you can make a movie on your phone.
Well, I don't know if I would do that.
Or you can make a movie about your phone.
I could make it would just be all our phones. Yep. It would be called All Our Phones, and we'd
all our phones are belong to us.
This is WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City, and in Rockland County, we're at 91.9 FM. And all over the world, you can hear us online at WFMU.org. What's next week's film?
Okay, so I'm out next week.
What? Where are
Alan,
you going?
Alan's
going
to be
Alan?
Here.
Oh, Ask Alan is on next week? Oh, we got to stick around for Ask Alan next week.
I don't know. The week after? Are you on the week after?
I'm not because Mrs. Bucci is going to be on the week after. So we have 3 weeks. Before. What would you recommend for 3 weeks?
A Reflection of Fear.
Is that the sequel?
No, it's just has a similar title.
Thank you to Micah and to Sean Cole. Micah's Music and Mind Control is coming up next. Please stay tuned. Do you have a song to play? Is it ready to be played? Yeah. Should I be saying this on the air? I'm just going to keep talking. I'm sorry. Thank you for the call, line one, but the show's over.